You know, of all the apps I have on my phone, the one I don't think I could live without is Cell 411. Cell 411 is a great free app that allows you to set up public and private cells for dealing with things like crime, emergencies, setting up a neighborhood watch, activism, or even helping protect your kids from bullies on the street. Cell 411 allows for real-time chat with your cells and provides turn-by-turn directions to your exact location. It also allows for real-time video streaming, which is then stored on the Cell 411 servers in case a roving gang of thugs, or the police, but then I repeat myself, attempt to destroy or take your phone away from you. Cell 411 can be found on the Google Play Store, or on iTunes, or at getcell411.com. Get Cell 411 today.
And they're supposed to do their magic stuff. And
I'm recording. This is the Freedom Fiends, live and worldwide, from a windowless bunker at an undisclosed location in the rural wild Mountain West in the occupied states of America. So, Phil. Hi, Phil Warmoth.
Michael, hi.
I'm
well.
Good.
How are you?
I'm good. So, it's summer. Do you work in the summer? What are you doing?
Yeah, I paint.
You're an artist?
Yeah. No, I should put that on my card, but no, really. I paint houses.
House artist.
It gets me into places I don't really want to go, but I get paid for it. So what are you going to do?
I don't know.
You want to hear some? You want to hear? Yeah. I have tons of painting stories.
Yeah, so go ahead.
One of the weirdest ones was a woman called me up on a rainy day. I was painting her dock, right? And the dock is in the water. So that made it a little interesting. But she calls me up and yells at me for not coming to paint. But I said it was raining. And she said, but you need to finish the dock. It was one of those things. So I couldn't go there before 11 in the morning because she never got up before 11.
Yeah.
And the weirdest thing was she asked me one day, she said, can you help me bring down some pellets for my stove in the basement? I said, sure. I go down there. There's five freezers. Right. There's five freezers in her basement. Right.
It's her ex-husbands.
Well, this is what I think it was all the ex-workers, because I was talking to the lady that was cleaning her house and the lady said, this lady's just like too weird. I can't deal with it. So she was quitting that day. So
were you packing?
That's what I'm. No, I was packing my 3-inch brush, man.
Oh.
Yeah, it was weird. She kept asking me all these questions. She'd talk to me constantly during the job, and she literally had me, she had a shake shingle house, little house, and she had me painting the individual shingles because they were, they weren't like, you know, uniform or something. And then she
had
this,
how wood is, it's not,
oh,
uniform.
Man, I know. And then she had me paint this little wishing well thing she had, and I thought it was a real well, right? Well, come to find out, it wasn't even real. It's like that whole job wasn't even real. You know,
you ever seen those signs in garages, you know, where you take your car and you get fixed and it says like rates, $50 an hour. If you watch, $70 an hour. If you help, $90 an hour. Yeah.
Oh, so when we first got to Maine, there was a big ice storm and it gave me a lot of business. I was just starting out actually. And so I got this one job where this couple had their church help them build a house, and consequently the materials for the house were all donated. So a lot of times, you know, the 2x4s were twisted and all the corners of the drywall were broken off. So anyway, I'm in there and same thing, man, this woman just stands behind me when I'm painting, right? And the gentleman had broken his leg in the ice storm. He was trying to clear his driveway with some branches and he slipped and fell or whatever. So his big thing was to sit in the middle of the living room and watch the Cartoon Network all day, right? So it came time for me
it's
to
painkillers.
Paint. Yeah. Something. I don't know, man. So I go to it was time for me to roll out the ceiling, right? And I said, I painted all the way around him, had this big hole in the middle of the ceiling where I needed to finish painting. I said, excuse me, do you mind moving? Just give me like 5 minutes. He goes, no, go ahead, paint right over me. I'm like, what? The guy was so lazy, man. He wouldn't even get up and move. So I made him hold a newspaper over his head while I painted the scene. It was ridiculous. Yeah.
That sounds like a cartoon, man, but it happened.
It happened. Wow. I could go on. Yeah.
Go on.
Oh, man. Let's see. What else?
Do you tell.
Well, yeah, the same place, actually. I just wanted to get the job done so badly. And the last thing to do was the bathroom. And the bathroom was really dark. The lighting in the place was bad. And I had the flu, man. But I just needed to get this job done. I was done with it. So I went there. I was all sick, bordering on hallucinating, actually. And painted it out. You know, same thing. Lady standing over me. Packed up all my stuff. Said my goodbyes. Left. A couple days later, I get a call. She said, you painted the bathroom the wrong color. I said, you know what, lady? I'm done. I walked away. It was probably about a $300 loss, but it was totally worth it for me. And the funny thing is that I'm partially colorblind. And I think we talked about this before. My grandfather, who owned that hardware store in Westfield, that's who I inherited it from. So he's mixing, you know, I don't know how many millions of gallons of paint for people over the years. And he's partially colorblind.
He mixed the paint for our house. I think this explains a lot.
Did he get it right? Did he get it right?
Well, it's all white and blue, but the blues are kind of very slightly different shades. So
I think that's why, you know, like we used to love it when the farmers would come in because all they wanted was red. We got the red down. We had that. But then, you know, like when I was working at that apartment building in Seattle, all I did for 5 years was paint apartments because people would get in there and trash
pick up syringes.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, for sure. I've seen syringes painted over before. Yeah. Yeah. Pretty sad.
That's the
man.
Show title right there. I've seen syringes painted over.
Yeah. I've seen things.
Some of the best minds of my generation were syringes painted over.
Yeah. It's true. You can't make this stuff up, man. They used to have like these were the building itself was what's called a resident hotel. I did some research on it, and that would be a place where like if you were going to go in a fishing boat up through Alaska, it would give you a permanent residence, but basically it was nothing more than a room and a bathroom, right? But I would spend sometimes a month in these places because people would just trash them like down
they had
to
bathrooms? I thought they had shared bathrooms down the hall.
Nope, not this one. So later it was developed and cut up and the housing authority took it over and they were running it into the ground. And so I happened to
Governments tend to do. Got to put that in there.
It was bad.
If we're going to have a show where we don't talk about the government for 2 hours, I got to say, run into the ground by the government. Okay, there, I've done my quota for this hour. I'll do one next hour. Please continue.
Thank you. So the odd thing was I couldn't find the building. I was assigned the building. I tried to get there as fast as I could because I would get the pick of the free apartments because there were three other staff besides me. And the way Seattle's laid out is it's bizarre. You'll have a street that starts and then like 100 yards down the road in either direction, it'll start back up again. So I couldn't find this place, man. 903 Union Street. So I jumped in a cab and I asked the guy, I said, you know where that is? He said, yeah, the Cambridge building. I used to get my drugs there all the time. I'm like, wow, really? This is great. So I get there and I walk into the office and nobody's there, but I hear all this commotion in the back room, right? So finally, I'd like spoke up and this woman with she was a Caucasian woman with a like a native headdress on, like, but just like one feather. I'm not even making this up, man. And she pops her head out and she says, can I help you? And I introduced myself and she said she gave me the numbers of three different apartments and the doors were open so I could go in and look around. But I was wondering what they were doing in there, and come to find out, there was this old safe. The thing must have been like 5 feet by 4 feet. I mean, it was just solid. And they were trying to break into the thing, man, trying to solve the combination. They couldn't do it. So that was my introduction to that place. And the apartment I picked was a nice one because there were a bunch of people living in there. And right before I showed up there, they burned the place right out, so it was all redone. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, and then just so many weird adventures. I can't even tell you, man. But that's going to be my novel. I started it, but it's going to be a long process. And the idea behind it is that it's depersonalized. There are no names of the tenants. They're just known by their apartment numbers.
So each chapter is a room number, so like, or each person
301
is a room number.
Yeah. Both. Yeah. Yeah, both. Yeah.
Nice. So,
yeah.
Yeah, we've already started creating art from that building in song because you have a couple poems about it and we've turned them into music.
It will live on, yes.
You know, that one poem, I think it was one of the first things we did. I didn't realize, like, I was multitasking so much. I didn't realize I took two completely different poems of yours and put them in one song, and they kind of worked. You know, the one about the bathtub and exactly. the dream. Yeah. And they just, it sounded like it was all the dream, even though half of it was real.
And it was a real nightmare, too.
Yeah.
And actually, the part about the bathroom was my first chapter.
Why were you trying to empty a shop vac into the bathtub?
Because that's what you do, man. You know, but otherwise I had to wheel it all the way down the elevator and out the side door by the shop there.
Wouldn't it clog the pipes?
No, it wasn't that clogged. I could not figure it out. And then when I did figure it out, that was horrifying.
Oh, it was a sex toy or something?
Traumatized. Flushed. Yeah, it was. There was no plumber training for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just one of many. There was a woman, she lived right down the hall from me. I get a call from her at least once a week, and her drain would be plugged up in her sink. And I'm like, okay, so what are you doing? I couldn't figure it out. Well, it was her teeth, man. It was her bridge. Her bridge fell down in there, and it got caught up, and every once in a while, it would let stuff pass by, and then it wouldn't.
Wow.
So I finally took the whole thing apart. And then there was uncleanable toilet. I could not dislodge this clog. I could not figure out what it was. But it was such an old building that the tank was bolted to the wall and had a big gooseneck on it. So for me to tear it apart, it would be some work. And these people would call me every Friday night. I'd be sitting down to dinner when I'd be on call. They'd call me, right? It was predictable. And I go there, and there were like six people living in this studio apartment. It was pretty ridiculous. And I could not unclog this toilet. So finally, I said, the next time it happens, I'm going to rip that thing off the wall and I'm going to figure this thing out. So I had a new toilet on a dolly with all my gear ready to go. And sure enough, it happened. So I got them all situated, and I took a sledgehammer, little small sledgehammer, hand hammer to the toilet, and it was full of newspaper. So they were using newspaper for toilet paper, and you know how newspaper gets all gunky and like glutinous and stuff. So, yeah, man.
It's all the lies in the newspaper that makes it sticky when it's wet.
Right.
Because, you know, they say, there's a saying that I really like. It's the only thing true in the newspaper is the date.
I like that. And the national debt, probably.
And the national debt. Yeah. No, because there's secret national debt. There's like black ops and, you know, this stuff where like the secret plans to assassinate, you know, democratically elected leaders in other countries. They can't put that in the budget. So they, you know, have soldiers guard heroin poppies in Afghanistan, and then they bring the heroin in. Or in the case of back in the 80s, it was cocaine. Yeah.
Don't they have like a line that just says other, you know?
Other. Well, you know, you do have a line for miscellaneous, but when it gets over 10 billion with a B, you have to go black ops with it. Black budget.
Yeah, I can see that. Sure.
Yeah. So how about that Space Force? You know about the Space Force?
Well, I heard it briefly mentioned in passing in the news, but I think Reagan already did that anyway, right?
Well, that was Star Wars. I mean, the idea was Star Wars, and then Star Wars sort of happened, though, because it's the drone program. You know, his idea was that there would always be things overhead that could drop bombs and spy anywhere in the world. And you can't really quite do that from satellites. You can spy. But you also can't spot, like, if you want to read people's license plate in real time and read what they're looking at on their phone in real time, you need a drone. It's satellites are too high for that. But the drone program is basically Star Wars. And no, the Space Force is like the president has been smoking something and watching too much. It sounds like that movie. What's the movie with the bugs in space? The Heinlein movie? That's really not a Heinlein movie.
I don't know.
Yeah, that thing. It was filmed in Wyoming. Like, they needed something to look like an alien planet, so they filmed in Wyoming.
Nice. That's why you live there, right?
That's why I live here, because no one can find it on a map. There was a White House map a couple years ago, that listed Wyoming as Colorado and vice versa. I like that.
Wow. That's good, man. Can you do that for Maine?
What's that?
Can you do that for Maine?
I don't know. I've been to Maine.
Actually, most people think Maine is Canada anyway.
Starship Troopers is the movie. You ever seen that?
Yeah, I never saw it.
It's like really, really vaguely based on a Heinlein book, but it's stupid and ridiculous, whereas Heinlein is brilliant and libertarian. Starship Troopers, though, is... like Trump said something the other day, like, we're going to have a space force. It's going to be great. It's going to be beautiful. And I have a friend that's in the army, and he's off on an injury, and he's home. So he's bored out of his skull. Yeah. So the other day he started calling army recruiting stations around the country and asking them if he could join the space force.
Nice.
And he called like a dozen of them around the country, and the answers were pretty much evenly split on the difference between F you and call the Air Force.
I want to see what the uniform looks like. I bet you it's cool.
Snazzy.
It's got to be some reflective material.
It's invisible.
Maybe some stripes on it to make them go faster.
Some racing stripes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So what else? We were talking about some stuff the other day. We had a pregame for this.
Yeah, we kind of were all over the place. I'm trying to remember.
And we're not now?
Something. No, of course not, man. our course has been well charted and mapped and filed with the authorities. So I know where we're going with this thing.
The authorities. I don't recognize their authority. Yeah.
I don't know. I was reading this article this morning. Kind of was interesting. It opened up with this Austrian physicist and some philosopher guy. He's on a bus, right? And he's sitting in the bus, and he looks down the aisle, and he sees this guy, and he's like, in his mind, he's saying, this guy's kind of shabby and kind of, you know, weird looking. I don't trust this guy. And he was looking in a mirror, man. It was a mirror. It was a rearview mirror, like, for the bus driver. So, like, there's this whole article about this thing called depersonalization disorder, which I never heard about, but it's like where you don't see yourself as a person, you see yourself as an object. Ooh. And this one woman, it's an account of like how she ended up being involved in a bunch of like kind of shady stuff, and she eventually kind of just lost herself, man. And It took years for her to be diagnosed, but when she was diagnosed, there really wasn't much they could do for her. But she said that she was at least relieved to know that, you know, at least that it was a phenomenon. So she goes from being like living an objective life to a subjective life. So she keeps jumping back and forth between those two dimensions.
From subject to object.
Yeah. And she said like the one thing that really helps her is just being around people. Like, so I think if she was in isolation, she would have a really hard time with it, but there's really not much they can do about it.
Some psychological maladies are so abstract that I'm surprised they repeat to other people, you know?
Right. I think it was this was like really the percentage of people that had this was 1-2% of the population.
That's a lot. That's
it's enough to get it into the,
that's like 3 million to 6 million.
Enough to get it into the DSM-4 or whatever it is now.
Well, DSM-9.5. Yeah. I don't trust that thing because they just keep expanding it. And I do believe that psychotherapy has use, but I think that psychotherapy is so intrinsically linked with government that I kind of think they're expanding it to the point where if they want to, they can diagnose anybody with a disability
or with
something that will take their guns away or something that will take their job away.
Or their life away.
Yeah. I mean, oppositional defiant disorder, ODD.
That's a good one.
Or
I like
ODD.
That.
I mean, yes. Every libertarian has all the symptoms of that, you know, everybody, which, you know, there's probably people yelling at the radio and it's true. They're all crazy, but, you know, oppositional defiant disorder. Let me pull that up. You as a teacher, have you encountered that phrase or?
Sure. Of course. Many, many times.
Really? Yeah, like kids get diagnosed with it?
That was one of the programs that I ran. I worked with those students.
The central scrutinizer is a Soviet-style Leviathan trying to keep track of all you do. That's why I use a VPN, or virtual private network, from Bola VPN. Bola VPN is inexpensive, secure, and will allow you to use your computer without leaving a trail. Bola VPN is now also offering torrent seed boxes for safely sharing media with the world. And if you open a support ticket saying you heard about them from the Freedom Fiends, they'll add 3 extra days free. That's Bola VPN at BOLEHVPN.net.
Oppositional defiant disorder, let's see, it says a pattern of angry / irritable mood, argumentative / defiant behavior, or vindictiveness. Unlike children with conduct disorder, defiant disorder do not are not aggressive toward people or animals, do not destroy property, and do not show a pattern of theft or deceit. So basically, they're just normal in every other way, except they are argumentative and defiant. And I mean, who decides what's argumentative or defiant? If the teacher's wrong and you repeatedly raise your hand and point it out, you're argumentative and defiant, but the teacher's still wrong, right? You know,
this is true.
I saw a meme. I mean, I don't know if someone made this up or not, but it looked real. It was like crazy letters home from teachers to parents about kids. And there was one that was like, you know, it had the kid's test and his short essay question and the teacher's comment and then the principal's comment and then the psychiatrist's comment all on the same page. And it was like, you know, the teacher had thought that a kilometer was longer than a mile. And the kid said in his essay question that, you know, the question is flawed because a mile is longer than a kilometer. And the teacher marked it wrong. And then the kid raised his hand in class when she said it wrong again and said, excuse me, but a mile is longer than a kilometer. And the teacher's like, no, it isn't. Sit down. And he's like, but you're wrong. And the kid got in trouble for being politely, you know, not screaming, not interrupting, but raising his hand and like repeatedly saying, but you're wrong. And the teacher even said in this thing, like, even though it turns out the student was right, he was being disruptive. Like that kid could get diagnosed with ODD and drugged, you know?
Unfortunately, I think that's pretty common. If you look at education as an institution and institutions control people, then that kind of thing is going to happen. I've seen it happen a lot, actually, where it's power struggles. It's nobody wins in a power struggle, but it's that institutional control that, you know, people aren't willing to give up. Like, have you ever heard of a guy named Irving Goffman?
No.
He's a social anthropologist and a sociologist. He was really active in the 1950s, but anyway, he did this experiment where he went into he got a job kind of like Ken Kesey in a way, you know, kind of the undercover in the mental institution type thing. But his whole premise of his biggest body of work was that institutions create institutional behavior. So when he went to define it, said an institution is anything that really controls people's behavior. So if you think of the military, you think of schools, you think of churches, you think of, you know, jails, prisons, military, things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Space Force.
Right. So he basically just observed for, I think it was a big hospital in Washington, D.C. And so I think he observed for about 6 months and gathered data, and he had the full approval of the administration. And one of his findings was that whenever the institution would enforce some rule that people felt was unfair or ridiculous, the people would counter with this different, you know, kind of conduct disorder type behavior, just like what you were talking about, or oppositional defiant behavior. And so one of the things was, one of the ways they controlled the severely mentally ill patients was they would only let them go to the bathroom at certain intervals during the day.
Ugh.
So quickly what people found out was they would piss on the radiators.
They would pee. Hang on.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So the patients would have to urinate on the radiators. So just to defy the schedule that was the artificial schedule for people. I mean, you know, our bodies don't follow a regular schedule. Yeah. Come on now. But it was the same for like Solzhenitsyn when he I was reading the
archipelago gulag
there. Yeah, however you say that, the flamingo pelago thing. He that was a big thing too. That was a big control element is your bodily functions. I mean, when
jail too.
Yeah, for sure.
So I've heard. I've never been.
Well, when I did, I had to do a few crisis calls at the jail. And when people are in crisis, there's a special cell for that. And there's just a grate in the floor where you that's your bathroom. And you're basically naked in a Velcro sleeping bag. And that's how you gotta
And the people that are more defiant are in the cell below the grate.
Good one. Yeah.
That one's going into the song. So we're recording a song right now. People don't really realize it, but do you want to explain that?
Well, I'm a big fan of the old cut up. And for
What's
those
a cut
of you
up?
That aren't, for those of you that aren't, funny that you asked that. For those of you that aren't familiar with a cut up, it actually originated way back before William Burroughs, who really gets the credit for it. But it was a method that the surrealists and even before that the Dadaists used. And basically, it's this random assemblage, almost like a collage.
Semi-random.
Well, I guess it could be semi-random.
We do it semi-random, but yeah.
But yeah, so the outcome is a complete surprise to the author. And to me, that I love that.
Yeah.
And then when we collaborate on them, we just build on these abstract constructs.
Yeah,
and it usually comes out really good. I you know, you can search for meaning in there, or you can't. You know,
but you hear meaning that wasn't intended, especially with repeated listenings. And there's actually four ways that we do this. I think maybe five, but one way. Well, the old-fashioned way is typing the words out and then taking a razor blade and cutting them up and moving around. That's how Burroughs did it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we're modern, so we use computers. So we have a few things. One is we have the Biptunia Lyric Generator, which is a little script website with a little more programming behind it than a lot of websites. But it's a web page on the Biptunia site. And I took a lot of the lyrics from our first three albums and cut them up into like line length lines, you know, like one line, like how you type it across the screen.
Right.
More or less. Some are longer, some are shorter. And then it's a random generator where it takes like 10, I think 20 of them, and just takes out of a list of like 200 and takes like 20 and randomly puts them above and below each other. It's actually shorter than a whole line. It's like a half a sentence, you know, like the beginning or the end of a sentence maybe. And it comes up with some really interesting changes. And then we usually go through by hand and change them a little more. One thing we've been doing a lot is taking the random assemblages and then adding, I don't think we've even talked about this, but what I do, and I think you do, is like add some connectors to make them correct speech, even though it doesn't make sense. Like we'll add
the word I do that.
And right. or sure. because or in addition to connect two of them and make them make sense. And then we read them as if this is the fun part. Talk about reading them as if they are real speech.
That was one of the most difficult things I've ever done, honestly. And you were doing it in isolation, and I was doing it in isolation. And the only way I could make it work was to read a line or what I perceived as a line and then record it and stop and then start with the next line. And that was even difficult. And then when you actually recorded you doing it, and it was on the album. And like when I heard that, I was so relieved. And
Making of that I released separately from the album, which was I didn't record it and stop. I kept the tape rolling, kept the recording rolling. We still say tape. Isn't that weird? Like print to tape. Start the tape when there's
A record. Let's make a record.
Yeah. A record still makes sense to me though, because it is a record, a recording of what happened. But album, I guess that makes sense. An album before music, an album meant a collection of things. Like you could have an album of stuffed birds. I guess an album would probably be the card catalog of the stuffed birds. Do you remember Westfield Library, the James Prendergast Library.
I remember it. I've never set foot in it, though.
No, Prendergast is Jamestown. Patterson is Westfield.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, huge library for a town of 3,000 people. It's an amazing library. And one of the things that they have in there is stuffed animals that you can check out like books.
Really?
Yeah. And I used to I'd get a raccoon, put it on the fridge, leave it, check it out for two weeks, and then get a chicken the next week and a squirrel the next week. And yeah, it was fun.
Do they do body checks on those things when they came back? Or? Wow. That'd be bizarre. That's cool.
I'm a fan of hiding things in plain sight. Like you could, like, you know, let's say you had something you needed to hide from the fuzz. You could take out the squirrel and then hide it in the squirrel. And then take it out later after the heat's off.
Right. Yeah.
I actually have an idea. I had an idea of how to, because the government, we're going to come back to cut-ups, but the government started searching people at airports to see if they had Bitcoin, to see if they were trying to smuggle large amounts of money out of the country.
Huh.
Because, you know, for some reason, the government thinks it's their money. If you want to, you know, it's funny because people always say, if you don't like America, get out. And then if you try to get out, there's like a leaving town fee, you know?
Huh.
They want to cut. I know a guy who did this, like a guy who, you know, has $30 million and he moved to Singapore and then he got a tax bill from the U.S. government. But for like still working in Singapore, making money in Singapore, you know, and he ended up like going to the consulate and renouncing his U.S. citizenship and becoming he had to do that. It would cost millions of dollars. And, you know, people say, like, your citizenship is the most valuable thing in the world. But when Singapore is welcoming and, you know, by not renouncing your citizenship, it's costing you $10 million, it's kind of hard to not at least consider it, I think. So he did that. It's a guy named Roger Ver. His nickname is Bitcoin Jesus because he got into Bitcoin when Bitcoin was like 5 cents and he bought like $10,000 worth at 5 cents, you know, and it's like $5,000, $6,000 now. So,
wow.
Yeah. Bitcoin Jesus. But, Bitcoin wallet, you know, can contain any amount of money. And like, unlike a bank transfer where if you send more than $10,000, you have to like file with the government and paperwork and it takes 3 days. It has to go through a bank and you have to talk to people to do it. Like with Bitcoin, you could send $30 million from one country to another in about 10 minutes, and it would cost, you know, a couple dollars maybe.
Wow.
So I actually thought about this thing of like how someone could – just a mind experiment of how somebody could hide money in plain sight. And I'm not encouraging breaking the law. I just like – when someone says you can't do something, I like to think of how it could be done. Did we lose you there? Come on back. Oh, yeah. I forgot. Rolling.
Right before break, you were talking about Bitcoin, right?
Well, we got rudely interrupted because I forgot that I have the computer in Minnesota that we're talking through Minnesota at GCN. I have it set up to reboot twice a day.
Oh, I see.
At noon 30 and midnight 30 Eastern time.
So, yeah. We got booted.
I forgot to tell you that.
Sorry. It's okay.
Well, yeah, because it's... I'm looking at a meme of Trump in front of the Death Star, and it says, "We'll rebuild the Death Star. It'll be amazing. Believe me, so luxurious, and the rebels will pay for it."
Nice.
Yeah. So Bitcoin, and the reason I do that, by the way, here's some news you can use: is computers work better if they're not on all the time without rebooting. So if you have a mission critical computer, like, you know, like things lives depend on, like the one we used to do this show, you should reboot it at least once a day. You know, a lot of people leave their computer on for weeks. And this is a thing I encountered a lot when I started doing shows with other people over Fiendphone, or before that, even over Skype. It's like computers just slow down when they're on for a week. So, yeah, you got to reboot them. But you can't reboot them 2 minutes before the show because, A, sometimes they do they do an update and you don't have any way to turn it off with Windows 10. So I say reboot it an hour before the show. And also because if a computer works best, I'd say between 15 minutes after it started And then after about 20 hours, 24 hours, it probably starts slowing down. So I always reboot it. So it's completely rebooted at least 15 minutes before the show. And then, yeah. So Bitcoin. So a way that someone could, you know, if they were joining the Space Force and they were going to go, if they were like going AWOL from the Space Corps, right, the Space Force, and they were going to go work on the asteroid mines, the, you know, most dangerous jobs in the universe that pay the most for unskilled labor, for, you know, semi-skilled labor. And they wanted to take their Bitcoin with them, or whatever their cryptocurrency of choice is. So basically, with a lot of Bitcoin wallets, you can export the wallet as 12 words. And this is mind-blowing to me. Like, you'd think it's only 12 words, and it's from a list of words. Like, it's not 12 words out of a million. It's like 12 words out of 300. And, you know, like egg, factory, drama, sky, kite. They're all like one and two syllable words. And like, if you have those 12 words, you can, you know, like delete your wallet, throw your computer in the ocean, go to another country, and then reconstitute your wallet and have your money from those 12 words, which is weird to me. I don't really understand entropy that well and mathematics. It seems to me like that's far too low of a number. And you could sit around typing words all day and within a day or two get someone's wallet with a lot of money, but you cannot. It would take like more time than there are grains of sand in the world or something. But so yeah, you could smuggle your info across borders by, you know, in the Space Force going to the asteroids. I'm speaking theoretically, by publishing it into a poem and then publishing it on Amazon as a Kindle book.
Wow.
And then when you get to the asteroid mines, you just order one copy of the Kindle book. And you do it like, it wouldn't be obvious. Like maybe it'd be the last 12 lines, like the last word of the last line of each of the last 12 lines of the second to last page. Something like right. that, you know? Yeah.
Or throw it in a cut up.
Yeah, man. Throw it in a cut up.
But that's the way to do it.
You'd have to uncut up it, and that might be problematic.
Or stuff it in a squirrel.
Stuff it in a squirrel and take it back to the library. Man.
There you go.
That's the show title right there. Stuff it it into a squirrel and take it back to the library. That's,
I like it.
That's
speaks to me, man.
It's literary. We like that. Back, take it back to library. So the other ways that we do cut-ups, you know, one way is, what's the first way? Oh, the Biptunia lyric generator.
Right.
So then another way that I've done it, I don't know if you did it this way or not, but there's a website called, I think it's called Language is a Virus. It's like some quote from Burroughs, and it does cut-ups for you, and you can set the entropy. Like you can set it to make each line three lines or four lines or three words, four lines, eight words, or anywhere like randomly between three words and eight words. I think that's what I did. And you could do things like have it repeat a word. That's how I did that one song. I don't even remember. We have like half an album already for the new album. Do you know that?
Wow. No, I didn't.
We have four
that.
Songs and all together they're like 32 minutes.
And we got Kip's song.
I've got two musics too that are in process that don't have words yet. So
nice.
lay some stuff on me. And if you don't, I'll lay some stuff on me and cut something up. The other ways we cut up, let's see. So all of these ways involve doing whatever we do and then writing some connecting words. And like, I kind of read it out loud as I'm editing it until it sounds like a sentence, not even grammatically, but yeah, I guess grammatically, even if it's nonsense, you know, like Jabberwocky was perfect English, but it made no sense. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of did something a little different. I didn't use that site that you referred to, but I referenced any written material I could get my hands on, whether it was the back of a shampoo bottle or instructions on how to put your grill together, and meshed it all together like that. And you get all these kind of really bizarre, weird descriptions and sometimes visceral, sometimes mechanical, combinations of things that you normally wouldn't do. You know, you wouldn't think that way.
I wonder if that's how the Dr. Bronner's soap label was done. You ever seen that?
I love that. Oh, Yeah, that's...
I'm looking at it right now.
I enjoy reading that.
We should probably just read that for the last half hour of the show. Yeah.
I think we should make a new... Make our own.
Yeah, it's like... I mean, this is a... So people who don't know, there's this hippie soap called Dr. Bronner's soap that's made by this crazy, brilliant dude. I think he was a Jew who escaped the Holocaust, if I remember correctly. And I think he died a while back, and his kids, his, you know, 60-year-old kids run the company now. And it's, you know, multi-million-dollar company, but it's kind of like a home, still a home business, but he has like 20 employees or something. this is a bottle of soap. Okay. Dr. Bronner soap. Google this. So here is like 1/40th of what's in tiny, tiny letters on this bottle of hope soap. It is a bottle of hope.
I like really. What you said there. Yeah.
A bottle of hope. That should be a, show title or a song title or a book title, chapter
could
title.
Could be all three. Who knows?
it could be the epilogue in your book where everything else is just a room number for a chapter.
And a syringe that's painted over.
A syringe of hope.
Yeah.
a used syringe
no,
of hope.
No, that's not good. No.
Okay, so it says... And this soap, like literally on the bottle, it suggests using it for everything. Like it suggests using it for washing your body, washing your dishes, washing your pets, using as birth control. I don't know how effective it'd be at birth control. I wonder if there's any kids named Dr. Bronner because of this.
I think the bottle is the birth control element.
If you
there.
Own it, yeah. No one will sleep with you. Yeah. No,
something like that.
I knew some hot hippie girls that had this back in the day. And my sisters, who I'm not saying are hot hippie girls, but I can't really say that because they're my sisters. But I think other hippie men thought that. But, you know, they had this. So it says, at conception, 10 milligrams contained 100 million humans, 10 humans in one invisible microgram, smaller than dust. A great teacher first must a self-liberating hard worker be, like Beck, Carnegie, Cousteau, Hammer, Lieberman, Payne, Pike, Spanger, Spinoza, Strauss, Wilke, Zemhoff, or he'll turn the greatest teaching into spades to bury people, all people, added Carpenter Jesus entering manhood. But for 2,000 years, we rabbis never teach the moral ABC of the real rabbi Hillel taught Jesus to unite the human race in our eternal father's great all one God faith, for we are all one or none, all one. For example, Einstein's Rabbi Levy evicted us from his university, Princeton Hillel Foundation, when we asked, you agree, of course, that Hillel's hard work, speech, press, and profit-sharing moral ABC unites the human race in our eternal father's great all-one-God faith, the exact opposite of Marxist socialism that does demoralize, divide, decay the whole human race today. I don't know what that means, but it sounds anti-communist, so I like it, you know.
You know what I think that is, man? It's either a cut-up or a rant. I think old Dr.
Think
Bronner was...
both.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, because it has the sound of that and that kind of choppiness to it.
Emmanuel Bronner. Man, the picture of him looks like a mad scientist. Let me send you this picture. It's like...
Yeah, I've never seen
a
picture.
I mean, the picture of him, he's got like... Like there's like mist coming up below the product that he's holding, and he looks like Dr. Strangelove. Okay, there we go.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm gonna send you this. We're gonna do internet on the radio here, but Dr. Bronner looks like Dr. Strangelove, and let's see.
Or maybe the other way around. Who knows?
Oh, that's possible. Yeah, let's see when that picture was taken. He's blind. It says a picture of a blind man wearing dark glasses and a white coat, grinning, holding a bottle of soap. So steam, presumably dry ice, billows from below, giving the photograph a science fiction feel. That sounds like a description for blind people. It really does. I have a friend.
He looks
blind
like wow.
Go ahead.
He looks like Lou Reed and Monk put together.
Lou Reed and Monk. I like that. Well, they're both Jewish.
Yeah.
So and they're both crazy. Like.
And throwing Bill Nye for some fun.
I don't like Bill Nye. Yeah. Bill Nye thinks he's a scientist and he's really not. And he, you know, I don't like him.
He's a good comedian, if nothing else.
Yeah, but unintentionally.
physical comedy.
Wow. Bronner was born in Heilbronn, Germany, to the Heilbronner family of soap makers. He emigrated to the United States in 1929, dropping Heil from his name because of associations with Nazism. His family was Jewish and pleaded with parents to emigrate with him for the fear of the then-ascendant Nazi party, but they refused. Oh, wow. Oh, my. His parents died in the Holocaust, and he begged them to leave Germany. Wow.
Oh, man.
His last contact with his parents was in the form of a censored postcard saying, "You were right, your loving father." Oh, man, that's just heartbreaking.
That's brutal. Yeah. I know.
A censored postcard.
Wow.
I just want a moment of silence. But you can't have a moment of silence on the radio. You know why?
Dead air.
Mm-hmm. You know what happens after 6 seconds of dead air?
No.
Literally, alarms go off at our radio broadcast place. Because usually talk radio hosts can't shut up for anywhere near 6 seconds. So if there's 6 seconds of silence, it usually means something's broken. And literally, like, with a flashing red light goes off in Minnesota. You know, it's not that what we're saying is so important, but it's that something is being said. I mean, we could just be reading the Bronner soap for 2 hours and it would not go off. But as soon as we stop, it goes off. Now, think about that. When we were in college, if one of my teachers had said, you know, like if our English teacher, when we were in college together, had said, "Michael, you're interrupting. I think you have oppositional defiant disorder." And if I said, "Someday what Phil and I say will be so important that if we even stop talking for 6 seconds, alarms will go off," he would have told me to go stand in the hall, man. He would have thrown me out of the class. But
he would have caught you an archetype, man.
An archetype.
Gave you the boot right out in the hallway.
Yeah. Oh, archetypes. Yeah, we learned about them from, what was that lady's name?
I can't remember.
Called the Nazi. She was German and looked like she was kinky and liked to wear, you know, Mistress Ilsa boots or something. Mistress Ilsa of the SS boots. What was her name?
Wow. I can't remember.
Wow.
But yeah, that was a blast from the past.
Yeah. So I didn't even get through all of the ways that we do cut-ups yet. And, you know, this is the way I've gotten better on radio over the years, is I always still ramble, but I finish my stories. Part of it is I make notes. I write down, like, you know, come back to that story while we're talking. But so the other two ways we do cut-ups is, there's actually three more ways. So there's five ways altogether. So you send me a recorded poem, and then I usually put the poem in as it is in the song, although I've been starting to take more care with doing that, of cutting it not out of order, but just cutting it into like phrases and putting them on beat and putting more space between them. So it's more on beat. So it sounds kind of more like, I don't know if a rap, but more like maybe a nursery rhyme, you know, it's not iambic pentameter, but like it works. So that's not really a cut up. That's just spacing. But then I take this program called, it's a VST program within Cubase, within Reactor, called Grain State. And Grain State is what's called a granular synthesizer, which is something that's been around since the 60s, but it's only been around like really usable for the common man who didn't have like a room full of a computer equipment for like 5 years. And not many people use it because most people make dance music these days. And we don't make dance music. We make head music, brain music. I mean, it's all got a beat, but
so make your brain dance. Yeah.
So basically I take the poem, you're recording the poem into Grain States. And then I record it to another track while I'm playing with the azimuth controller, which is basically a dot on an XY axis on my computer screen. There's a few different azimuth coordinators. But basically I just move it on an XY axis, and the XY axis is, let's see, X is X from left to right. I haven't been to school in a while.
I failed math.
Okay. So the left to right axis is where in the piece it samples. Like if you're at the far left, it's going to get the first word. If it's the, you know, almost to the far right, it's going to be the last couple words. Mm-hmm. And then up and down is the length of the sample that it granulates. And it can be anything from like I think the bottom is like four words, five words, something like that. And the top is like a 20th of a syllable, maybe a 50th. And then it goes through Echo also, which also has an azimuth coordinator. And then there's also an azimuth coordinator for resonance. And I just intelligently move those around with the beat while listening to the song. And that's where you get those kind of like echoey. It kind of sounds like a vocoder, but not quite. It sounds even weirder, but more organic somehow. Like vocoders always sound like robots, because basically vocoders don't – they take the input talking, they sample it, and then they throw that away and build a simile of it with the computer. So it does – it is a robot voice basically.
Yeah.
But
I don't like that.
Yeah. I've used it a little bit. I think I used it on me a few times, but
Hey, I saw your t-shirt from across the room. That's pretty cool.
Thanks. I looked all over for t-shirts with designs and sayings that define my unique taste, and I finally found it.
Who makes them?
Wormshirts.com.
Wormshirts.com?
Yeah, Wormshirts.com.
That's weird. Why'd they call it Wormshirts.com?
Probably because Wormshirts.com is easy to remember. Worm, like the critter that crawls on the ground, and shirts, like what they are, t-shirts.
Wormshirts.com. Cool. Do they make them for women?
Yeah, they have men's, women's, and children's styles, a bunch of colors, and all sizes, and they're quality cotton shirts.
I'll look up Wormshirts.com right now on my phone and check it out. Wow, they have lots of designs. I've never seen any shirts like these.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Hey, let's get out of here. We'll go over to my place and I'll order some shirts on Wormshirts.com. Then when they arrive, I'll try them on for you.
Worms!
That's Wormshirts.com.
Yeah, so the grain states is pretty cool. It's the granular synthesis, and nobody really uses it because everyone makes dance music now, and you know, you can't really dance to grain states. So that's another way we do it. And then the final way we do it is I take your poem and, you know, again, I usually lay the poem in legibly at the beginning of the song or pretty close to the beginning of the song and then mess it up later because I want
people
to hear the poem. Yeah.
Yeah.
We never talked about that, but I knew you loved it without even asking you because it's the thing you should do, you know?
It is.
Put the poem in and then you mess it up. So, because then it's in people's brains too. And then you mess it up and they have reference for it. So the other thing I do is take the poem and cut it up into 16. It's always 16 little chunks, like one word, two word, three word, whatever kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then I map it to a sampler and then I play it. I used to do it with a keyboard, but then I got this cool thing I like that kind of looks like a paddle with little drum pads on it. And I play it with my finger and I assign it to different notes. And each phrase gets two notes a half step apart. And there's 30. If I go into the second scene, there's a button for the scenes. There's 16 buttons on this. And I can go to the second scene and I can play melodies with it. And you didn't like that because I went high. You didn't like your voice.
Yeah, I didn't like it. Yeah.
Was it because it sounded womanly or just what?
There's a thing, man. I read an article actually about why people don't like their own voice, the sound of their own voice. I think it was on one of those ASCAP blog things, but there's science behind it. There's two different theories, but the one that I liked was that you have three voices. You have your outer voice, your inner voice, and your inward voice. And your inward voice is the voice that you hear like when you read a book, right?
Ooh.
It has to your mind, you have that voice, but you've never even heard it out loud yourself.
That voice is British for me. Sometimes it is. I think I put on like voices for, you know, if it's a British character, I think I hear it. But even if it's like a Cockney guy, I hear it in a proper like, ooh, indubitably, which is actually Queens. Kind of more like a mid. What's the accent? The East Coast, like last century accent.
Appalachian. Yeah.
No, Mid-Atlantic. Appalachian is redneck, but the Mid-Atlantic is like the high falutin, like journalists.
The Queens.
But journalists spoken it like really good example. War of the Worlds guy. What's his name?
Oh, Orson Welles.
Orson Welles talked like that. He was American as they come.
Yeah.
But he was, he sounded kind of British.
Yeah, it's very common in the 1950s for American actors to have that British sound.
Because
actually, Kipkin did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, classical I like when training. He does
it. Yeah, yeah, like that's what theater training taught right. back then. Yeah. William F. Buckley totally talks like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Best of you seen Best of Enemies?
No.
It's a documentary about William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal. It was like, you know, the new right versus the new left on TV.
Oh, wow.
It was brought, it was like one of the first like really like long form newsworthy things. Like I think it was 10 debates. And they televised all of it. They were like an hour
wow.
each. And it's them sitting in a chair wearing suits sounding really – they both sound like this. Like they both sound like, well, frankly, sir, I think that you right. are an idiot. Yeah, well, you, sir, are worse than Hitler.
Touche,
you
know? Touche. Yes.
Yeah, and it's like two intellectuals, like a far right and a far left intellectual, like back when people had class, you know. Now they right. just say, like, you're worse than Hitler. I'm going to find out where you live and kill you. Like, that's what people say on the internet right. all day. But this was like two classy, educated East Coast, you know, elites talking very mm-hmm. politely. But they were like destroying each other. But really right. intelligently.
Intellectually. Yeah. yeah.
Back right. when, you know, people could form complete sentences.
Right.
Yeah.
And use capital letters and everything.
Yeah. Yep.
It makes me think of, you know, the bat walk up the side of the building. Even the bat walk was intelligent repartee, yeah, yeah. right? You know, we've just really devolved here. I don't know what's going on, but.
Yeah.
It can't be technology because we're using it and we're not devolving, are we?
Are we evolving?
I feel it.
Well, you know, Devo, the band Devo was, the phrase Devo meant de-evolution.
Absolutely.
And it was fun. Yeah, so the band Devo were named after the word de-evolution, which I think is a biological term, but it's not a common one. I think that Mark Mothersbaugh heard it in college when he was going to Kent State. You know, he was at Kent State, like, watching those kids get shot when that happened.
No, I didn't know
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. That's like you should just write a postcard to your son as they're shooting you saying, or your dad saying, you were right.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Too soon? No. But it is. It is too soon. It's always too soon. Well, there's a saying from my friend Claire Wolfe who said that we're at a strange time in political history. It's too late to change things by voting and too early to shoot the SOBs.
Huh.
I don't know if that sounds violent. We're peace-loving men here on this show. Yeah. So Devo, the idea was de-evolution. And, you know, it was kind of like, you ever seen the movie, the much later movie called Idiocracy?
No, I didn't.
You should see that movie. It's really funny. You should at least watch the first 5 minutes of it, which I think are on YouTube, the intro to it. Basically, the premise is, so the most average guy in the world is selected for an army experiment. He's a soldier. He's a private. He has like an IQ of 100. He's 5'9". You know, like everything about his average looks, like everything about him is average. So the army picked him for this experiment because he's the most average soldier in America. mm-hmm. And they put him in this pod and, you know, they were supposed to like see how he could live in suspended animation for a year. And the army forgot about him and he gets reanimated, like brought back to life like 500 years later. And everyone has devolved so much in the world that he is now the smartest person on the planet.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds like a Twilight Zone episode.
It does, but it's a comedy. And so there's a theory that I heard recently is that people are no longer evolving because there's no more natural selection with humans because, you know, sick people don't die because of medicine. Right. Poor people don't starve, at least in Western countries. People that don't want to work can eat. mm-hmm. You know, there's like all these systems in place and advances that the unintended consequence is that we're not evolving anymore. There's no reason for it.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to live forever. How can I do that? Dr. Bronner's soap and Bitcoin?
I think so. At least, yeah.
Music.
Worth the try, right?
Yeah. I just want to keep making music. I think that'll...
I think that's the solution right there.
Yeah. Until I can buy a kit for $300 at Walmart that like transfers my consciousness into the cloud, I think music is how you live forever. Art, talking.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So tell me something good.
So I think you said we're making an album kind of in this whole process right now, man. So
I know.
So all the listeners, you know, you're part of this.
I know.
You know, you're collecting. Yeah.
I've actually like heard live records where they say, "Good evening, Cleveland. And I want you to know that right now you are going to be on a live album." And everyone cheers. So I'm saying that right now to the audience in the non-live cut up technology. Everyone has powerful computers on their desktop, and I actually know how to use them, and so do you. But you know how to write poetry and talk, and I taught you how to record, and I'm going to make music. It. Yeah. So you're all on a live record right now.
3 million of you.
Yeah. Probably more like 10,000, I think.
That's good.
We get about 1,000 downloads on radio, I mean on podcast each episode, and we have about 10,000 listeners on radio. So
that's good.
Yeah. I make it hard for them to talk to me too. Like we don't take calls. The email address is hard to find. If you have to talk to me, you can find the email address on the Freedom Fiend site, but I don't really like to talk to you. I like to speak to the world in one direction. Like sometimes a new Freedom Fiends fan will, or a host will join the show who's usually a fan who, you know, eventually there's an opening and he's a good talker, and he buys a microphone or I buy him a microphone, teach him how to use it. And I'll see him like a couple weeks after he starts on the show, I'll see him like screaming with some liberal on the internet, like back and forth, like, "You're wrong, blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, "Dude, you don't have to do that anymore. You're on radio."
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Screaming in general isn't an effective form of communication from my experience. Anyway.
Really?
But yeah.
Then why is so much rock music screaming?
I think
primal.
I think it goes down to the root, you know, the core of your being kind of thing. That you're doing it to see if you're still alive, right?
Yeah.
But that's screaming at people, I don't think that's directed at people. I think
William F. Buckley didn't have to scream at people on the street.
No, he couldn't if he wanted to. His teeth were too big.
Oh man. Was he looked like a Kennedy. He sounded like the Kennedys had that accent.
They did. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. It's called Mid-Atlantic accent, but the nickname for it, this is really funny, it's called Long Island Lockjaw.
Wow.
Like, well, lover, I do believe you kind of
right. Yeah, I get it.
Like I can picture Buckley talking and he's barely moving his mouth, you know?
Yeah. 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 I had a friend, man, that could had that down. Like he could do it spontaneously and just like rip one right off, man.
Hey, let's tell it. Why don't you tell a story about Jamestown back in the day when we met? One we haven't told on radio. Is there one?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. What
did I know you for told? 1 year or 2 years at JCC? I can't even remember.
I don't remember myself, actually. Probably one. I'm guessing one. I don't know. I remember the first time that we actually even spoke to each other. That was kind of interesting.
Tell me.
English 101 again. And we got our first assignment, which was, I think we had to write about somebody that we admired. And so I wrote about Pete Townsend. I think you wrote about Roger Waters. And the teacher, once we had our assignment,
I thought you were going to say we both wrote about each other, but we didn't know.
No, well, that was later. That was later, man. That was in creative writing. No. And I remember we were asked to exchange papers with the person next to us. You happened to be next to me. I didn't know you from anybody.
I looked like a hippie.
I do remember that, but I didn't know you.
Until I shaved my head. Until I started hanging out with you and shaved my head.
Man, that's the way to go. But anyway, so I had to read your paper. You read my paper and like, bam, we like connected because it was that intense attention to detail and how, you know, we really were tuned into lyrics and stuff. And then I think, we just started hanging out. You would play your guitar in the hallway in between classes and stuff, and people would stop, and we just kind of like, we collected this menagerie of people around us that eventually evolved or devolved, I don't know however you want to look at it, into the Armless Children. I mean, that was intense.
were you with me when I walked naked across the parking lot that day?
No, but I remember you told me about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was weird because it wasn't like, it was not an exhibitionist thing. It wasn't streaking. I wasn't running. I had no shame. I was walking. I was sauntering. And basically it was like, it was a really hot day. It was, you know, one of the last weeks, you know, upstate New York, it's like hot and muggy by, you know, June 1st.
Right.
And I was walking across, I think I was with Greg Bowles and some other person, and I took my shirt off because I was like, man, it's hot out here. And, you know, everyone's blinded because I'm so white. They're like, putting their sunglasses on. And then I said, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that you can't take your pants off. I mean, if you can take your shirt off. And I don't know if one of them said, do it, or if I just did it, but I took it off. It was like, it was kind of just, it wasn't for attention. There was nobody there. It was like, you know, during classes, we were showing up school late. It was like in the middle of class time. So there was nobody in the parking lot. And I fully intended to put it on before I walked back into school. But I was kind of challenging convention. I was having oppositional defiant disorder, I think. And I was just like, well, yes. I'm really hot. I want to take all my clothes off. And I did. I put them back on, walked in. And then a couple days later, this really beautiful, really shy, kind of nerdy girl that I could tell was really smart, glasses, just seemed really smart, even the little she talked to me. She came up to me and she said, hi, you don't know me. I'm whatever, Jane, plain Jane, whatever her name was. And she said, but
Dr. Bonner, wasn't it?
Yeah, Becky Bonner said that, right. She said, you know, I've been looking at you and admiring you all semester. And I thought you were a really cool person. Until I saw what you did yesterday in the parking lot. And I'm kind of thinking, and at the time I was thinking like, man, I could have like got to know this girl. But then I'm thinking like, why would I want to, you know, if that harmed her? Yeah. She wasn't for me. Yep.
Yeah.
Do you ever, this might be like bad, like asking, you know, a soldier if they ever killed anybody, but did you ever find any dead bodies when you were working in that junkie hotel?
Oh, yeah. One right next door to me. I think yep. I told you that, didn't I? No. Oh.
Tell us. We'll make a song out of it.
Tell the tale. All right.
Is it okay? Is it too soon?
No, it's okay. It's not too 20 soon. Years. It's been 20 plus years. Yeah. So I don't know if you've ever gone like without sleep for prolonged periods of time, but sleep deprivation does
no
things
comment.
To your psyche. It wrecks your psyche. So anyway, the apartment next door to where we were living, my wife and I in Seattle in the 90s, became
Seattle
vacant
in the 90s. Were you friends with Kurt Cobain?
No, I was not.
Okay.
But anyway, so this old alcoholic occupied
were you friends
the apartment.
With the other guys from Nirvana?
No, I was not.
I was. Okay.
I will go on record, but yeah, anyway. So for a period of about 2 weeks, this guy, as soon as he moved in, he just like his schedule was the complete opposite of ours. So when we were trying to sleep, he was awake, vice versa. So this apartment building was solid concrete, right? And I remember I was gonna try to hang a pretty heavy duty picture frame up on the wall. So I got a hammer drill. Expecting for the wall to really give me a fight.
Hammer drill.
Well, I went what's a hammer drill? So when it sounds drills, violent. It drills like clockwise with the bit, but it fluctuates back and forth like a jackhammer. Wow. So it'll penetrate concrete.
Oh yeah,
with a
yeah,
little
yeah.
bit of effort.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm giving it everything I had, and all of a sudden, boom, it goes right through the wall, and I'm looking through the hole, and I'm seeing the guy's apartment. The walls were like maybe like 5 inches thick. That was it. Geez, I said.
Gosh, golly.
So it was no wonder that I was hearing him.
I had to stop the tape because that definitely, boy, that story, can't say that on radio. Okay, let's go back to talking about dead people. You can talk about that on radio.
All right. So anyway, I realized that the walls were pretty much paper thin. So that was the driving factor for me to go down to the property manager and say, look, man, this guy's been keeping me up for 2 weeks straight. He's been like ridiculous. Like I would sit there. I'd be like drifting off in that really nice little part where you're almost asleep, right? And then all of a sudden I'd hear. And the thing was, he would laugh, man. He would laugh.
Well, he was probably shooting heroin, and heroin puts you in that place all day.
Oh, man.
Place where you're kind of, like right when you're falling asleep, but you're still awake. Yeah, that's
so literally. Like, I get this adrenaline surge, and I'd be pounding on his door before I even knew I got out of bed, right? So this went on for 2 weeks, and I said, look, I can't do this anymore. I said, either he goes or I go. And she said, all right, well, we'll take care of it. So they started the eviction process, right, which really wasn't legal, but they did it anyway. And all of a sudden, he was supposed to have all his friends come over and move him out like he had a deadline. And they stayed up all night and partied, so I knew they weren't leaving. So I'm
literal
like,
deadline.
Now what? Well, the deadline's coming.
Literally.
So I knew he didn't leave, and I thought it was going to be this prolonged engagement, let's say. And then all of a sudden it was quiet, and I thought, well, maybe he just like, you know, booked it. But in the meantime, he fell asleep one night. He was a smoker, and he fell asleep, and a cigarette fell between his legs and caught his chair on fire. But he had passed out, so by the time he woke up, his chair was in flames. So he dragged the chair down the hallway and stuck it by the dumpster, and it was still smoldering in the morning. So we're like, what's up with that, right? So anyway, it's been quiet for a few days. And I was like overjoyed because I got a couple nights sleep, and I started to recharge and feel back to my normal self. And then the maintenance guy approached me down in the shop. He said, you're not going to want to open up your windows for a while. And I'm like, what are you talking about, man? And basically what had happened was he had all of his windows shut, and these windows went from the floor almost to the ceiling, so they were humongous. And basically, he baked himself to death. He must have had a heart attack or something, but the coroner said he was dead for 6 days. He had been dead for 6 days.
That's a long time.
So it's a long time. It's gross because
it's hot, but yeah.
Literally, his foot turned to jello. It was it was part of the shag rug. So anyway, once all this came out, the cleaning crew just refused to go in there. So it sat for another week. And like in the meantime, it's permeating the walls.
Well, there's companies
like,
you have to call. Actually, legally, you have to call a company that specializes in human waste. But there's companies that do that. I actually called one. I read an article about them in the paper in San Francisco around the year 2000 when I was writing my first novel. And there was a character in my novel who died. You know, it was someone who was actually still alive, but they were a junkie. And in my book, I changed their name and had them die of an overdose. And I thought, you know, I'll have her cat eat her or partially eat her. And I actually called up this place. It was called Crime Scene Cleaners, a company in the Bay Area. And I said, hey, I'm writing a novel. This is not a joke. This is a serious question. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, you know, cats and dogs ever munch on their owners if they're dead for a few days before they get found? And and he said, oh, it was an email. It wasn't a phone call. And he wrote back and said, kitty's got to eat.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a name for another episode right there.
Yeah. Kitty's got to eat.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the place was just getting worse and worse. And I said to my boss, I said, clear my schedule for a day. I'm going in. So I suited up and I went in and I just, but the thing was, before the manager and the maintenance man let me know that this had gone down, they went in there. They removed the new chair after the one that he burnt materialized. They dragged it down the hall, and the unintended effect of that was that the guy fell out of it, and they were always looking on off, man. It was the gross. That was the grossest thing I've ever had to do, and I've had to. That's just gross.
So the
man.
Moral of the story is drugs kill kids.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I would say I'd put in the libertarian part here that illegal drugs kill, because if drugs were legal, that guy could get pure precision, properly dosed drugs. Wouldn't have to hide, could do it with other people around. It would be more socially acceptable. He could have people that don't take heroin over just hanging out, like people have a beer together. His friends could have a couple beers. He could shoot some heroin. They would all have a loaded syringe of Narcan present, which is what you use to bring someone back from an overdose. Yeah. You know, with if drugs were legal and they were coke, heroin, and speed were available at Walmart, as someone once said, hopefully not in the same aisle as the sugar to avoid confusion.
Hmm.
You don't agree.
I don't, but that's okay.
That's man. Okay.
We can okay. we can you agree will. To disagree.
I'll brainwash man. You. It'll take a while.
Oh, maybe I'll de-evolve before then. Who knows?
You'll devolve.
Or dissolve, well, maybe. Yeah.
I don't think people devolve. I think I don't think persons devolve. I think people in general devolve. The human race.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's the...
Go ahead.
I think it's the... we don't need to rely on our instincts so much anymore. I right, think that has right. a lot to do with it.
You know, something I heard that's kind of interesting about why people have heart attacks, you know, other than that... Well, it's basically our bodies are designed to, you know, run away from saber-toothed tigers and... chase bison and throw a spear into them. Like that's what mm-hmm. our bodies evolved to do. And when you take that body that's evolved to do that and you sit them in a cubicle in front of a computer with fluorescent lights, no natural light, and feed it coffee, you know, caffeine and sugar all day. So we have a limbic system that is developed to have a fight or flight instinct, you mm-hmm. know, to run or to fight when attacked by, you know, a giant cat or a saber tooth, whatever, or mm-hmm. another tribe. And we don't need those instincts for the most part anymore. I mean, there are still situations where that comes in handy, but for the most part, the average person never uses that. So what happens is when their boss comes in and says, you did this wrong, like they get the same surge of adrenaline mm-hmm. that they would have gotten to fight off a saber tooth tiger. So yeah.
And I think that's the, me. I think that's our anxiety ridden society right now.
Is it's not my society. You got a mouse.
It's an anxiety ridden society.
Well, I'm like that kind of, but I'm not part of society. So I opted mm-hmm. out. I don't have a mouse in my pocket. Well, cool, man. How are your kitties?
Doing well, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're liking the air conditioning. They're both really long-haired. Yeah.
Ours are medium hair. My wife's been started brushing them like every day.
Mm-hmm. Do they let her do that?
Oh, they love it. They climb up. Like she does it on my dresser, on top of my dresser. On one, I have two dressers in my room. And one of the dressers I have, we have separate rooms because we have completely opposite schedules to where mm-hmm. if we shared a room, we'd keep each other up all the time. So
right.
my room is kind of my office too. And she comes in my room after work usually, and like as soon as she stands by this dresser, all three cats jump up there and fight to get brushed or kind of push each other out of the way to get brushed. And it's really cool because one of the cats is totally bonded with her. Like it sleeps on top of her and mm-hmm. it licks her and it loves her and it follows her around and yells at her if she doesn't pet it enough. That's Bipcat, the Biptunia logo cat. Mm-hmm. The other cats were kind of cold to her, and partly because she was out of town when I got Bob. Like, Bob was feral. Mm-hmm. He lived on the street for months. Like, they said when he got him, he was covered with ticks, and they cured him of that and stuff. But he was really sick when mm-hmm. I got him. I didn't know he was sick. It's kind of weird. Like, every cat I've ever gotten from the shelter is mm-hmm. sick, but you can't tell until you bring him home. And then you take them to the vet, get antibiotics, and they get better. But Bob was so sick, he was dying. And I nursed him back to health while my wife was out of town seeing her mother. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Bob was like, he wanted to live, but he couldn't eat and he couldn't drink. And I was taking water and getting it on my finger and rubbing it on his lips and mm-hmm. on his tongue so he'd get some water and not die. Mm-hmm. And after like 2 days of that, he would kind of like raise his head a little bit and I'd be able to put a drop in and he'd kind of like half-heartedly drink it. And then after like a week, and we're given I was giving him antibiotics from the vet. And after mm-hmm. like a week, he started eating. I mean, he hadn't eaten in a week and he'd barely drank in a week.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he started eating and he has never stopped eating. Like This is a cat that when he's full, like he'll eat all the food and then he'll just follow you around like a wild beast and beg for food.
Wow. Yeah, that's a thing cats do. They just stop eating. You know?
Weird. Yep.
Well, it's good. Everyone's healthy.
Yeah. So what else, man?
Oh, man.
I got to wrap it up here, but.
Yeah. Well, I think we should give a shout out to Chandler with his new book there.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Which is a tome. It's a tome, man. It's I have it right here. It's, I think, 171 pages or something. Yeah, 171 pages. And this is just the first installment. But I went on Amazon Books and looked. He got a good comment. It's tough being a poet. You don't get the attention. People don't really key into it as much as other forms of art. But, you know, it's the whole making yourself naked like you did running across the parking lot there. You know, it's kind of like, you know. You do it.
Yeah.
And you hope people connect in some way. And I'm looking through the book and I flagged quite a bit of pages here. But
I hear it.
I'm glad. Yeah. Let me. There you go.
Yep.
No, a lot of. I mean, it's so. What's the word? Diverse. You know, even like jumping in and out of genres and stuff. But I think it really lives up to what it says it is. It's an exorcism. It's getting it out. You know, I think that was the whole point of it. And he did it. He did a good job with it. So I think I'm proud of him. Yeah, me too, man. Yep. I can remember inviting him to like kind of his first open mic situation. And I think he's come a long way. I think it's kind of like very intimidating when you first decide to share your work with the world and not know how it's going to be received.
It's like a message in a bottle.
Yeah, it is, man. You throw it out.
Did I tell you I did a message in a bottle when I was a kid and threw it in Lake Erie?
Uh-uh.
Yeah. My dad and I did it together. It was my idea, and my dad helped me write it because I was like 7 or 8, and I said what I wanted to write. And we said, if anybody finds this, please write me a letter. And we put our home address. I would never put my home address on something I'm throwing out to the public now because people are crazy. But and I threw it in Lake Erie. And about 3 weeks later, we got a letter from someone in Buffalo that found it.
Oh, that's cool.
And my dad thought that was so cool that he called the paper, and the Westfield Republican, the local paper, wrote a little article about me, interviewed me. It was the first time I was interviewed. Oh, we were talking about the sound of our own voices, which we love. Mm-hmm. I love the sound of my own voice, even though I think I sound like a stone surfer, and I'm neither. But the only time I ever thought my voice sounded weird was the first time I heard it, and I was 3 or 4 years old, and my dad had a tape recorder, like a little desk reel-to-reel one with 3-inch reels, a Wowensack. And he recorded me. He had it for dictation. Like he had a secretary, and he'd dictate letters, and then she'd type them up. Mm-hmm. And he recorded me and played it back, and I thought, that's not me. And then I fell in love with it. And I was like, I love the sound of my voice. And I was like, you know, I sounded like this. But I've always liked the sound of my voice. I think you can't really do talk radio without loving the sound of your voice.
It's interesting too, that you brought that up, because when we decided to put together the band, the Armless Children, I was voted to be the singer. Right, I can't sing, man. But I sat down. My aunt, who was a career teacher, gave me her old Wallensack reel to reel, which was like from the 1960s.
Wow,
bigger reels than 3-inch for sure, and. I sat and I recorded myself over and over and over again singing or attempting to sing Syd Barrett and Led Zeppelin, and it just didn't work. It didn't work, man. I had to turn to poetry.
We invented a way to make music out of poetry that is good. Nobody else is doing what we're doing. Like, I've heard there are some records by well-known poets that is poetry.
Leonard Nimoy. Yeah, Leonard Nimoy.
But man. None of them are doing what we're doing. They're either, now it's rap. Like, rap is poetry over music. And it's, you know, some of it's good, some of it's horrible, some of it's great, but it's at least like on rhythm, where a lot of it was like, did Leonard Nimoy or was it the other guy?
Oh, both.
Scotty. Okay, they both did records? Yeah.
Yeah, both William Shatner.
William Shatner's was so horrible that it's like people listen to it ironically.
Yeah.
Jim Carroll did a record of poetry to music.
Yeah, you turned me on to that.
I didn't think it was very good. I like his music better or his poetry better, but
I think his music with poetry is better than his poetry. Vice versa.
So yeah. I'm talking about like the song People Who Died, which was his hit.
Yeah. That's right.
He's kind of singing in that, but he did a record that's just reading poetry without any rhyme, like without trying to fit it to the music like that. And it's not very good.
Okay. And I don't know that
there's
one.
There's a Jim Morrison record that was done posthumously where they were like, he recorded his poetry, you know, because he decided at one point he didn't want to be a rock star. He wanted to be taken seriously and remembered like his heroes. So he booked some studio time and recorded a bunch of his poems. And they never got released until after he died. And the Doors, I think this is really cheesy and I don't like that they did this, but they put out a record. Hmm. It was called a Doors record. And it was like Jim Morrison reading his poetry. And then after he died, the other three Doors like jamming to it. And it's horrible.
Oh, really? I don't know that one. Huh.
Yeah, but what we're doing is different. It's organic, and I like it. I'm falling in love with it. Like, you know, I still want to do like one song per record where I sing, and I'm doing some solo songs now. But the solo songs now I'm doing, I'm not singing usually. It's like I'm doing what you were doing. So I like it so much.
I do too.
You know, my sister, one last thing here. My sister said to me recently that, you know, she's going through her dad's stuff because he's gone into a home and she's helping him, you know, deal with all of it and do whatever with it. And she's like, you know, is there anything that you want? I can ask him, you know, if there's anything you want. And he has like valuable stuff. He has antiques and things. And I'm like, the only thing I want is if you could find it, is that the tapes for that Woolen Sack tape recorder of me talking.
That'd be cool. Yeah.
And the tape recorder. But even if she could just find the tapes, I could buy that tape recorder, you know, on eBay for $50 probably. So I just want the tapes, really.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yep. Well, man, you got anything to say to the world just before worms?
Nah, it's been good, man. We'll do it again.
It has. We will. I'm going to go make this into a radio show, a podcast, and a song, or several songs, an album, maybe an album.
Yeah, what was the name of it again? Yeah, of Worms.
Of what?
The album. Yeah, the show, the album.
The show is called Stuff It in a Squirrel and Take It Back to the Library.
That's what I'm saying.
A Bottle of Hope. I like the library one better.
How about stuffing a bottle of hope up into the squirrel, man? Is that what? And the squirrel smuggles a bottle of hope.
The Biptunia record that we're working on is called Bippertronics.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Named after Robert Fripp's Frippertronics, which most people don't even know what that is anymore. But yeah.
Man, if they don't, they should Google it.
Rob Buck did that from the 10,000 Maniacs.
He did. Like
Buckertronics.
He did it for us at a poetry reading. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was
where
good.
Where he'd like play solo guitar with a couple tape recorders, do an echo and play to himself and be ambient. It was cool. You know, I saw Robert Fripp do that. Did I tell you I saw Robert Fripp play live doing that at the World Trade Center in New York City?
No, still existed. Man.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It was in the lobby of the World Trade Center in probably 1991 or 94 or 89 or something. I was with this girl, Deborah DeSalvo, this writer and musician that I was dating. She took me there on a date. She was like, you know, meet me downtown at this subway stop. I have a surprise for you. And I was like, okay. And we went down there and she had a picnic and we ate the picnic while we walked. It was a walking picnic and we walked like 3 blocks to the World Trade Center. I'd never been to them. I'd been in the Empire State Building as a kid, but I'd never been to the World Trade Center. And she took me in the lobby of the World Trade Center, huge building. And like Robert Fripp was playing.
What?
And I was like, my mind was blown. I love Robert Fripp. And,
what? Me too, know, man.
He was playing a lunchtime free concert in the lobby.
Wow.
And he had this woman singing with him on a couple songs too. And she was horrible, but he was great. And it was funny because like Robert Fripp being the, you know, the proper English uptight gentleman he is. He makes great music, but he's a proper uptight English gentleman. He stopped in the middle of a song and yelled at people. He was like, I'm playing my art for you and you're talking. You shouldn't be talking. And I'm thinking like, well, then you shouldn't come to a place of business at lunchtime and expect people not to talk, you know?
I gotta segue into a quick story about Ravi Shankar. Ravi Shankar,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So Ravi Shankar came to the Paramount in Seattle in the mid-90s. So my friend, the maintenance guy, and I and both of our wives, we decided we gotta go. We gotta see this, right? So and at the time whenever we were working in apartments, like doing routine maintenance and stuff. If someone had like a bunch of CDs that were cool, I'd run down to my apartment and burn them, you know, or cassettes. I'd make copies of cassettes. Yeah, yeah. So we were like ravenously. Yeah, it's not a good thing, but I did it. Anyway.
Hey, is there a crime there? Is there a victim? I don't think there's a victim there.
I don't know.
I'm all for piracy.
So this is an honestly true story. So we go to see Ravi Shankar and we went out to dinner and stuff before, and they had just remodeled the Paramount Theater. It's beautiful, like an old opera house that was totally redone, and like plush velvet seats and a coffee bar, yeah, and everything. It was cool. So we're sitting there and he did the same thing. He was like being so pretentious. He would like stop if someone in the audience made like a little bit of a noise. So in the meantime, my friend, who's a maintenance guy, he knows his way around buildings. He disappeared, right? He got like really weird and he disappeared. And I went around. He was gone for like 20 minutes and I'm looking for him. I found him on the second floor. He'd found the electrical room and he was going to throw the breaker on the whole thing, man. I'm not even kidding you. Man. I think he had a mental breakdown and I had to talk him down. I literally had to talk him down to not do it, man. And then he really wasn't the same after that for a while.
Wow.
It was really weird.
It was the sitar music. It damaged him.
I don't know, man. I think it was just the pretentiousness of Ravi Shankar. Wow.
At least he had more of a right to say that. Ravi Shankar had more of a right to say that than Robert Fripp, because at least people were all there to see him. Right. Robert Fripp was just playing in a place of business, like, you know, the biggest office building in the world in the lobby. You can't expect everyone to shut up for 45 minutes, you know? I mean, wheels and deals, man. You know, wheels of the wheels of industry can't grind to a halt because somebody's playing ambient music. And also, I was kind of offended that he did that, because ambient music, which is what he and Fripp called that, Fripp came up with the word. The idea of ambient music is that it's background.
Right.
That you can do other things while you do it, and it doesn't require all your attention. So what's with telling people to not use it as background music? Yeah.
It's confusing.
Robert Fripp, he and Ravi Shankar were both religious and weirdly religious, which means like religions I don't know anything about, I guess. But Fripp went to an ashram in West Virginia at some point. He just gave up rock and roll. Huh. And I guess he got bored of not playing music there, and maybe he needed some money. And he started giving guitar lessons out of the ashram. Have I told you about this?
No. Is that where the League of
Crafty Guitarists came from? Yeah. And a friend of mine was in one of those classes. It was really expensive.
Oh,
it was
like
$5,000 for a weekend or something.
I thought they were free.
Oh, no. No. And it promised that you'd get to perform with Robert Fripp at the end of it. Like, you know, join this class and then do a performance with Robert Fripp. And the performance was like at a cowboy bar for four people that were sitting at the bar mad because they turned the TV off, you know?
Playing the same chord probably.
And it was. It was like everybody's playing acoustic guitar, and he had them all in a weird tuning. And, you know, it was like 12 people with acoustic guitars in a weird tuning with no amps, no mics, sitting on the cowboy stage at the cowboy bar playing nothing like cowboy music. And, you know, just the guys sitting there in the afternoon, in like 3 p.m. and just, you know, the drunks that are at the bar at 3 p.m. kind of mad because they had to turn the TV off for this. And it was like a deal Robert Fripp had with the bar. Like he gave them $50 or something each time he did this.
Oh, wow.
You know, so yeah. Yes, the League of Crafty Guitarists.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, and he did a live record with that. But my friend was in, went to that, and at the end of the class, right before that performance, how's this for encouragement? Right before that performance, like they had to go take the bus. Like they, yeah, you know, they went out in the rain with their guitars in cases and waited for the bus under the bus stop and took the bus into town to the bar. And then had to come back that way too. He told the class on the bus on the way there that he's like, I've done dozens of these classes and you are by far the worst class I've ever had.
Wow.
And I'm kind of wondering, just, you know, like the little I know about Fripp and seeing him yell at the audience, I'm wondering if he told that to every class.
Probably.
Like it's part of his teaching technique, part of his pedagogy. Is that the word?
His de-evolutional teaching technique.
Yes. It was annoying. So, yeah, but I like his music.
Mm-hmm, I do too.
All right, man. We got to wrap it up here.
All right. Good. Worms.
Worms.
Back at you.
This is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends. I've run websites since 1996 and have used over a dozen web hosts in that time. AgristHosting.com is the only one that hasn't broken my heart. Agrist Hosting's uptime and service is stellar, and their DDoS mitigation is the best I've seen. That's important because if you tell the truth in this world, you'll ruffle feathers. And some people will try dirty tricks to silence your voice. No matter what the haters hit us with, Agorist Hosting keeps our websites online. If you have a mission-critical commercial presence or a world-changing activism site, you cannot tolerate any skullduggery. So go with agoristhosting.com. Have a WordPress or blog site, but you're not satisfied with performance or uptime? Or just want raw hosting? Want to pay with Bitcoin? Agorist Hosting specializes in high-performance hosting with personalized service. Go to agoristhosting.com and click on the button that says Get Hosted. That's agoristhosting.com.